The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Please join me in welcoming William Penn Foundation Communications Director and Regional Foundation Center Advisory Council member Brent Thompson, who will introduce today's guests. Thanks.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm so glad to see so many people here today. You know, the opportunity to stand in front of nearly 300 people and introduce one of the most admired public speakers in our field is a little bit daunting for me. It's kind of like getting to throw out the first pitch at a Phillies game. Whatever you do, it's not going to have any effect on the outcome of the game, but if you throw it in the dirt, everybody's going to remember. My organization sponsored this event today really for two reasons. First, we're really proud to be part of the 35-year tradition of excellence and support that the Regional Foundation Center has provided to Greater Philadelphia's nonprofit community. Please join me in applauding the great work that Gloria Hibbett and Jen Donsky do every day for our sector and for the people you serve. Second, we all know that these are very tough times for nonprofits. Raising money in a brutal recession is incredibly difficult to begin with, but the challenge is made even more urgent by the effects of the economy on the people and communities you serve. In this environment, nonprofit groups simply must have a clear, compelling message, or you can forget about marshaling the support you need to achieve your mission. There's simply no one better than Andy Goodman when it comes to helping people understand the power of storytelling as a tool for getting across ideas and motivating others to action. His ideas have helped hundreds, perhaps thousands, of nonprofit causes across the country. His straightforward, common-sense approach to effective communications is intuitive and natural. It plain old just makes sense. And best of all, he's a whole lot of fun. Please join me in welcoming Andy Goodman.
Thank you. Thank you for that very generous introduction. So let's all begin by lowering our expectations. Good afternoon, doers of good. It's great to be back in Philadelphia. Philadelphia is like a second home to me. As I sit upstairs at a brunch, I went to college here. I lived here for 8 years, and I married a Philly girl. So Philadelphia is very much in my heart. And as I also sit upstairs, I come to Ocean City every year for 25 years. So I've eaten my share of cheesesteaks and hoagies and funnel cakes. So when I say Philadelphia's in my heart, I mean it's literally lining my heart. It may eventually stop my heart. But enough about me. I've come today to talk to you about storytelling and the importance of telling stories. And my thesis today is pretty simple, and my goal is very straightforward. I think stories are the single most powerful communications tool that you have. And my goal today is, if you have not been telling stories as an organization, I want you to leave here determined to do it. And if you have been telling stories, I want you to leave here determined to do it even more. But I know that this is going to be tough, because when it comes to storytelling, excuse me, in the nonprofit world, we have a problem. And the problem is not that we don't have great stories to tell. You have great stories. I know it. I've heard them all over the country. The problem is in the way we tend to tell them. When we get into a professional context, you're laughing already. When we get into a professional context, we burden our stories with so much jargon and acronyms and statistics that they become almost unrecognizable. And so what I want to do first thing this afternoon is I want to demonstrate the problem by playing a little game with you. I want to tell you a story that everybody in this room knows. Okay? Some of you I know, some of you I'm meeting for the first time, but I'll guarantee that every single person in this room knows the story I'm about to tell you. But I'm going to tell it to you the way someone from a nonprofit would tell it. Okay? Complete with PowerPoint support. And here's the challenge. Let's see how long it takes you to cut through the veil of jargon and recognize a story. When you know it, when you have it, just give me the high sign. Don't yell it out. Let's see how long it takes everybody to get it. You ready to play? All right. In reality, this story that you know very well, the title has four words. But in my version, it's called The Role of Family and Community in Mentoring Alienated Youth in the U.S. Midwest. Does anybody know what it is already? Okay. Don't say. All right, here we go. This is the story of an at-risk youth from a blended family in the economically depressed farm belt. One day, she is rendered unconscious by an extreme weather event, suffering severe head trauma. When she awakens, she undertakes a long, perilous journey to a distant, mineral-based urban center. And along the way, she's accompanied by three variously challenged and apparently homeless adults. Yeah. And when she arrives at this urban center, and I know you haven't thought of it this way, but this is what happens, she is hired to perform a contract hit on a reclusive sociopath. Is there anybody who does not know what the story is? Really? It's the Wizard of Oz. There's your at-risk youth. Now, you may say to yourself, you know, that's mildly amusing. We're not that bad. Let me tell you something. We are that bad. And sometimes we're worse. And I'll give you the example. Let's get to the real world now. I want to give you an example of a real nonprofit doing really wonderful work that was not telling a very good story. And that's an organization that is now based here in Philadelphia called Friends of the Children. Does anybody know Friends of the Children? Anybody know them? Nobody here is from Friends of the Children, are you? Okay. Well, here's the deal. This is a wonderful organization. Here's what they do. They basically... I've got water up here if anybody needs it. But, they basically identify, and I'll use the language, at-risk youth, in first grade. And these are kids who really have life's deck stacked against them. But they will admit them into the program and match them with a mentor, and that is a paid professional who will work with that child 4 hours a week, week in and week out, starting in first grade through 12th grade. Wow, indeed. So we're talking about a commitment through elementary school, middle school, and high school. And thanks to the depth and the scope of that intervention, they're seeing lives turn around that otherwise would have ended up on the street or in jail or worse. So do you have a general sense of what they do? Yes? Okay. Here's the problem. When Catherine Milton was their executive director, and she would go out and talk to groups like this to raise money, to try and get new mentors, to try and convince parents to put their kids in the program, she would get up to tell the story of the organization, and she would get in front of the room and say, "Hello, I'm Catherine Milton. I'm from Friends of the Children. Let me tell you a little bit about our organization." And she would put up slide one of her presentation, and here it is. And she would turn and face the screen and say, "Friends of the Children is an intervention program for the most vulnerable children living in seriously high-risk environments. Our vision is one in which teachers..." And she would read you the entire slide. And then she would go on to slide two. And she would read you the entire slide. And we were on our way through a 60-slide presentation. And I want to just I'll tell you, honestly, after just three or four slides, even a room full of atheists will say, "Oh, my God." Right? And that's not even my favorite slide. Sometimes when there were funders in the room and she had to talk about her theory of change, you all familiar with that term, theory of change? She would put up her theory of change slide, you know, and I'm like, hand to God, this is her slide. There it is. Yeah. I'll give you a minute to read it. So I was going to work with her, and she took me through the whole presentation so I could get to know the organization. And by the end of it, she said, she finished, and she said, "And I feel like I'm just not connecting with audiences." So I said to her, "All right, let's do this. Let's put this aside for a moment. And can you just tell me the story of one child through the program? Take me through the beginning, middle, and end of the program so I can see one child going through your program. Can we just do that? And she said, oh, that's easy. I'll tell you the story of TR. And she told me the story of one young man who'd been through the program. And by the end of that story, I was able to say to her, all right, Catherine, from now on, when you go out to groups, let's start with that story. And then you can come in with the facts and the figures and the metrics that say that there's more than one story to be told here. So she threw this presentation away mercifully, and I want to show you what became her new slide one. It's right here. She would come out and say, hello, I'm Catherine Milton. I'm from Friends of the Children. Let me tell you a little bit about our organization. This is TR. This is a young man we met in Northeast Portland, Oregon, when he was in second grade. And we interviewed him to see if he'd be a good candidate for our program. We found out that his mom was on welfare. His dad was absent. The neighborhood he lived in was beset by crime and gangs and drugs, just your classic bad neighborhood. But maybe the biggest, also, in first grade the year before, he had been suspended, are you ready for this? 22 times in one school year. But I think the biggest indication of where he was at as a human being are those three words. They asked him, TR, what were you like last year? And he said, I was bad. So here you have a child, 7, 8 years old, starting to believe in his heart that he's a bad kid. And I think at that point, the battle's almost lost. But this is the exact kind of child they look for. So they accepted him in the program, and they matched him with this guy, one of my heroes, Zach Harris. And Zach started to work with him 4 hours a week, week in and week out, getting him to school on time, getting him home, doing his homework with him, just being that solid adult presence that TR was lacking. And Zach could see that in a matter of weeks, he could literally see a life turning around in front of his eyes. But in a matter of months, he could see that all the good work he was doing was being undone by the gangs in the neighborhood where TR lived. Because when he would bring him back home at night, he was basically handing him back to the gangs, and they were unraveling everything he was trying to accomplish. So Zach realized that if he was truly going to help this young man, he would have to go one step beyond. He would have to go and confront the gang leaders. Think about that. Well, he did that, and I want to read you his exact words, because I can't say this any better. This is what Zach Harris said of that day. I recall going to the gang members one day. I will never forget the lump that I felt in my belly. This one gentleman had to be about 6'2". He's staring me right in the face, and he said, may I help you? And I said, little TR right there, he's mine now. He's going to be okay. And I'd appreciate it if every day he came home that you would send him into the house and not allow him to hang out with the guys anymore. And from that day, that's just what they did. They realized that this was a kid who actually had a chance. Well, that was more than 10 years ago. TR grows up to be this guy, number two, starting fullback for Jefferson High School in Portland, Oregon, recruited by Division I colleges all around the country, offered a full scholarship, took his SAT first time around, didn't do so good, but still had his friends in his life, so he took them again and did well enough to get into the University of Oregon, where I believe he is graduating this year. And they are so proud of this young man, they put him on the cover of their newsletter, and see what it says above his head? Here's a young man truly living a dream, thanks to the work of this organization. And as Catherine Milton will say, this is one life turned around, in this case, principally by athletics, but one of hundreds of lives turned around by athletics, the arts, academics, vocational training, whatever it takes. So let me ask you a question. Do you have more of a feeling for what Friends of the Children does? I hope so. Because what Catherine Milton told me is that when she would go out and start with that story, there was a palpable difference in the room. She could feel people connecting to her and her organization in ways that they had not in the past. And they were more open and receptive and interested in the facts and the figures and the theory of change and all that stuff. And this organization, by the way, still has storytelling at its heart. This is their annual report from last year. Look at it. It says 2008 annual report, Jeff Williams. There's no logo on the cover, nothing to identify at Friends of the Children. It looks like the story of Jeff Williams, which it is. Another young man who's been through the program, they tell his story so you can understand what it's all about. And then you turn the page and you get the facts and the figures, etc. So this is why I say to you that storytelling needs to be considered a best practice, not something that we just do before work or after work or at coffee hour, but an essential part of how we work. And I think, again, it is the single most powerful tool that we have. So that's the case I want to make to you today. And here's what we're going to do between now and 2 o'clock. First, I want to make that case about why narrative is so powerful. I think there are four things that make narrative the most powerful form of communication. I will lay them out for you, and hopefully after that you'll be nodding your head and going, yes, storytelling, very powerful. I am under your spell. You know? Then I'll ask you to open up your wallets. No. So if you're convinced, then your next question obviously is, okay, so how do I do it? So we'll talk about the qualities of a good story, the structure of a good story. You know a good story when you hear it. You know a good story when you have it to tell. You want every story you tell to be good. I'll talk about the essential qualities you need to build in to make sure that your stories are those kinds of stories. And lastly, how do you go back and institutionalize this? How do you make sure that you're using storytelling for fundraising, for advocacy, for recruiting, for internal communications, for external PR? You can use it in many ways. So that's what we're going to talk about. Now, just some ground rules here. If you have a question, because of the nature of this room, I can't take it until the end, but at the end we will leave room time for questions and there'll be pass around microphones. So if you have a question, hold that thought. We will get to you. All right, so why is narrative so powerful? Take a moment to read that for yourselves. Like I said, four things on the side of storytelling, starting with history. If you think about it, we've been telling stories for thousands of generations, from the earliest forms of humankind to the earliest fires we gathered around. This is how we communicated. If you think back in your own memory, in your own collective unconscious, deep in the memory of your reptile brain, it's in there. Remember when we were all sitting around the fire after the great hunt, when Og brought down the woolly mammoth and we're all eating the woolly mammoth? Do you remember that? Good woolly mammoth. And the leader of the clan said, Og, great job leading the hunt and bringing down the mammoth so we could all eat and so this clan can survive. We must know how you did it. May we see the PowerPoint presentation, please? Right? He said, tell us the story. And Og told us the story and it entered the life of the tribe. It became part of our culture. Well, you do this for a few thousand generations. And you get today a species, us, whose brain has literally evolved with mechanisms that look at information coming at us and look for hints of narrative, for elements of story to signal to us, this is important, this is worth my attention. You don't believe me, let me throw an expert at you. Dr. Stephen Jay Gould, the eminent paleontologist, biologist, before he died a few years ago, he said, storytelling is so central to who we are as a species that he called humankind the primate who tells stories. He said, this is our distinguishing characteristic from the other primates in the family tree. Not using tools, not art, not culture, not language, telling stories. So it's an indelible part of our history as a species. And that history is echoed in your personal history because hopefully from your earliest days, from your beginnings, your teachers or your parents read you stories when you were old enough to understand language. So your life begins with the fairy tales and the bedtime stories that eventually become the chapter books and the novels and the TV shows and the films and all that stuff, hundreds of stories moving through your life. And you, as a listener or watcher, you start to see the pattern. Things have a beginning, a middle, and an end. There are heroes and villains. People go on great quests. They run into all kinds of problems. They overcome them, they arrive at a goal, and we've all learned something in the process. And so you start to look for that pattern and information coming at you. And when you see that pattern, that resonates very deeply. So it's part of our history as a species. It's part of our history as individuals. And one more thing about stories. There's a story from your childhood that has something to say about storytelling that a lot of people miss. And that's the story of Peter Pan. You all know the story of Peter Pan, right? Yeah, yes? Okay, these are not rhetorical questions. Peter and the Lost Boys live where? So named because? They never grow up. And they never grow up because? And that's where I have you, right? Interestingly, in the original text by J.M. Barrie, there's a scene in which Wendy asks Peter, word for word, why are you not growing older? And he answers her. There's a very specific reason why they're not growing older. Does anybody know? They don't want to? I hear that a lot. They don't want to. Actually, not true. Not the case.
They have no one to read stories to them.
That's exactly right. Thank you very much. Wendy asks Peter, why are you not growing older? And he says, I don't know any stories. They have no one to read stories to them. And he goes on to explain that to know and to tell stories is to become an adult, is to enter the civilized world. And they couldn't do it. Now, there may have been a sort of a not wanting thing as well, but they just didn't have the mechanism. I think that's fascinating. You know, by the way, I ask this question all around the country. I speak to educated audiences everywhere, and I ask, do you know why? And you are a rarity. Most people have wild guesses. When I spoke in front of the CDC in Atlanta, I said, why are they not growing older? Somebody said, poor nutrition. Not poor nutrition. My other favorite guess, when I spoke in front of Women in Philanthropy in Phoenix, Arizona, there's a room this size filled with women. I said, why are they not growing older? And someone looked at the screen and said, because they're all men. By the way, for those standing in the back, there are plenty of seats up here, so please make yourself comfortable. Young Mr. Rejo, there's a seat here with your name on it, right here, so come on up, okay? So, first of all, stories are part of our history. Secondly, stories are part of your identity, are part of who you are. Here's your brain. There are hundreds of stories in it about who you are. Here are some of them. Roger Schenck wrote a book called Tell Me a Story, Narrative and Intelligence, which I highly recommend to you, S-C-H-A-N-K, Schenck. Listen to what he says. He says, we tell stories to describe ourselves, not only so others can understand who we are, but also so we can understand ourselves. Telling our stories allows us to compile our personal mythology, and the collection of stories we have compiled is to some extent who we are. Or he has a formula which is easy to remember. He says, you are the stories you want to tell minus the stories that nobody wants to hear anymore, which leaves the stories you tell. And if you want to have some fun tonight, this can be wonderful self-therapy. Take a piece of paper out, and on the top of the paper, write down the top 10 stories I tell about myself. The top 10 stories I tell about myself, and then write down the titles of those stories. And if you can't remember them, just nudge your spouse, and he or she will tell you the titles of those stories. But then look at them, and then say, if I was a stranger hearing someone tell these stories, what would I know about them? It can be a very sobering moment of free self-therapy. But the larger point is that your very sense of self is wrapped up in storytelling. Third, stories help us remember. And there's a study done in 1976 that speaks to this, that they did with five-year-olds. So imagine for a second you're a room full of five-year-olds. And I say to you, kids, I've got 21 pairs of objects I want you to remember. Okay? I'm going to read you the list. Pay real good attention, because I'm going to see if you can put those pairs back together later. And the pairs are pretty mundane. Soap and shoe. Fence and sky. Paint and grass. Etc., etc. I read you the list of 21 pairs. Okay, remember, you're five. And then I say to you, all right, you all hear that? You all remember that? Now go outside and play for an hour. All right? 1 hour later, I'm going to bring you back in. Now I'm going to test you to see how many of those pairs you can put back together. Soap and, fence and, paint and. 1 hour later, five-year-olds, how many do you think they put back together? Does anybody here have a five-year-old? Yes? How many do you think your child would be able to put back together?
One or two.
One or two? Most parents say exactly that, and the answer was one. One out of 21. Okay? Great. Let's get those kids out of the room. Let's bring in a new group of five-year-olds, presumably same intelligence level. Same 21 pairs, but this time a slightly different instruction. Kids, we're going to read you 21 pairs, but for each pair we're going to stop and ask you to put it in a sentence for all to hear. So the first pair is soap and shoe. I call on five-year-old Tommy sitting up front. Tommy, stand up and put soap and shoe in a sentence for all to hear. And Tommy stands up and says, "The soap is in my shoe." Thank you. Future novelist. 21 sentences. Kids go out and play for an hour. We bring them back and we test them. Compared to the previous group, how do you think they did? Same, better, or worse?
Better.
8 out of 21 pairs remembered. Third group, this time the instruction, put them in a sentence that asks a question. So I call on 5-year-old Olivia, and she stands up and says, "Can I wash my shoe with soap?" Very good. 21 questions. They go outside and they play. We bring them back an hour later. How do you think they did? Same, better, or worse?
Better.
16 out of 21 pairs remember. So look at these results side by side by side, and you tell me, what did the clinicians conclude was happening in these kids' brains by virtue of asking a question that allowed them to remember so much, and not as much by asking, giving them a sentence, and not at all by just giving them the pairs? What was happening in their brains? What do you think? They were thinking. Go ahead. Keep going.
Associations.
Making
up a story to answer the question.
Bingo. Welcome to the workshop. When you ask a question, what does the mind tend to do? It tends to answer. Whether you're interested or not, whether they're asking you or not, the mind just tends to posit an answer. This is, by the way, why so much advertising asks questions. Because they know you're driving down the Schuylkill Expressway, minding your own business, and you pass a billboard, and it says, "Wouldn't you like to be in Paris right now?" And you're like, yes, I would. You know? And suddenly you're in Paris. And suddenly you're driving off the highway. So, can I wash my shoe with soap? They ask the question, well, yes, I can. I take a little soap, a little water. And suddenly you have the rudiments of a story. Somebody's doing something to somebody or something else, and there's an outcome. So these kids left the room with 21 stories forming in their brains. And you'll remember, these are these very human brains that love stories, recognize them instantly, know where to store them, and know how to retrieve them. So when you brought them back in the room and you said, "Soap," little Olivia sat there and thought to herself, "Soap. Oh, I was washing my shoe with soap. Shoe." And she had the other half of the pair. And they did it, on average, 16 out of 21 times. So the takeaway from this study, and this is a big one for everybody in this room, when you have facts that you want people to remember, it is much more likely they'll remember those facts when they are contained within a story than if you just give them the facts. And I cannot underscore that enough, because with so many of the nonprofits and foundations and government agencies I work with, I'll come in to work with them and they'll say, "We just did this study. Look at these numbers. You know, if we just release these numbers alone, people will, you know, eat better, exercise more, put their kids in preschool, buy a hybrid car, whatever." And I have to say to them, it doesn't work that way. No one's going to remember those numbers. You've got to give them something to hold those numbers. You've got to give them a story. So history, identity, memory, and lastly, and very much salient for this group, stories affect how much we give, or if we give. And I got to tell you, people in the back, you're making me feel guilty here. There are seats here. Please come in and take a seat. Daryl, we got a seat for you right up front, so please be seated. Deborah Small and her colleagues at both the University of Pennsylvania and Carnegie Mellon did a fascinating study that is very relevant. Here's what they did. They took a bunch of college students, and they said, "We need you to come to this computer lab and fill out a questionnaire about your use of new technology, cell phones, iPods, you know, whatever." And so the kids came to this room to take this survey. And when they were done, they were given an envelope to say thank you with $5 in it, five $1 bills. But not all the envelopes were the same. half of the envelopes had a letter in it from Save the Children saying, if you could, would you give us some of this money back and donate it to Save the Children to help us fight hunger in Africa? And they supported the plea with statistics. 20 million people facing drought, drops in maize production, people dislocated here, et cetera, et cetera. The other half of the students got an envelope with $5 and a letter that told the story of Rokia, a little girl in Mali, who her and her family faced imminent starvation unless something would be done. And she represented millions of people across Africa, so won't you give back some of the money? Well, what happened? On average, students who got the numbers-based solicitation gave back an average of $1.14. Students who got the story-based solicitation gave back more than twice as much. So, history, identity, memory, generosity, all these things work together to affect the way we think and live, making stories, again, I believe, the most powerful, I would even say the most fundamental form of communication. Are there any doubters or skeptics left in the room? We're all ready to go on to question two. We're all good? Okay. What makes a good story? Please take a moment to read that for yourselves. The main point here is that not everything is a story, and not every story is good. If I said to you, I woke up this morning, I had breakfast, I came to the free library, I spoke to 300 lovely people, I got on a plane, went home, went to bed, that is not a story, as we're defining it today. That's just a boring sequence of events. You hear those all the time. To rise to the level of story, as we're talking about here, a story that people will remember and want to retell, there's a certain structure that you need to have, a structure that's been handed down to us from the earliest myths and fables that you use sometimes yourselves unconsciously, but I'm going to lift the hood and show it to you. There needs to be details, telling details, that in a few words evoke a person, a place, a feeling, pulls you right in. Emotion, truth, and meaning, I don't need to define those things, but it's all got to be there if you're going to have that kind of story that someone hears and just can't wait to tell someone else. So the best way to demonstrate structure and qualities is to tell you my favorite story. And for those of you who have heard this before, I ask your indulgence. The title of the story is It's Going to Be Okay, Jennifer. And this is not my story. It didn't happen to me. It happened to a guy named Richard Eyre, E-Y-R-E, Richard Eyre. Richard and Linda Eyre are parenting experts. And what they do for a living is they go out and find and collect moments of good parenting and then share them with other parents through their website, their presentations, their books, etc. In fact, here's their website, valuesparenting.com. There it is, Richard Eyre. If you're a parent and you're ever looking for good advice, it's a wonderful resource. But on this particular day, Richard Eyre is standing in the supermarket. It's his day off. It's Saturday. He's at the deli counter, you know, waiting for his pastrami or turkey or whatever, minding his own business, when a woman passes behind him pushing a shopping cart, like you see here. But in the shopping cart, in the fold-out section right here, is a little girl, 6 months old, 9 months old, whatever, and she's crying. Crying, 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 right in her mother's face. You know what I'm talking about? Has this ever happened to you? Right? For parents, this is the nightmare scenario. This is the meltdown, not halfway through the shop, not at the end, as you walk in the store, right? So that's bad. But as she passes behind Richard Eyre, he hears the woman say in this voice, completely calm and composed, "It's going to be okay, Jennifer. We're going to get the bread and the cereal and the honey, and we're going to go home." And off she goes. And he's sitting there, he watches, he's thinking to himself, that's impressive. I mean, this child is crying literally in her face, and she is completely calm and composed. He wants to know how she does it. He's thinking to himself, short of drugs, you know, what is her trick? But she's on her way, and he's waiting for his number to come up, you know, hello, number six, can I, thank you, gets his turkey or whatever, throws in his cart. Now he's pursuing this woman, looking down the aisles, trying to find her. Where is she, where is she, where is she? There she is. She's down the cereal aisle. So he starts to come after her, and even from a distance, he can see her, the child, still crying. Mother, still talking softly. "It's going to be okay, Jennifer. We've got the Crispix. We're going to get the honey and the bread, and we're going to go home. So he really wants to talk to her now, but as he's just about to approach her, some carts are coming the other way. They're blocking him. She doesn't see him. She turns and goes the other way. Gone again. So he thinks to himself, well, this is futile. I'll just go to the checkout counter, the express lane, and wait for her. That's where she has to end up, right? So he goes to the express lane. He is now standing there in full stalker mode, just waiting. And a few minutes later, she pulls into the express lane, and he pulls in behind her, and the child, still crying. Mother, still talking softly. It's going to be okay, Jennifer. We're going to put this stuff right here. We're going to pay the man. We're going to go home. So he taps her on the shoulder. He says, hi, excuse me. My name's Richard Eyre. I'm a parenting consultant. I look for moments of good parenting. I'm so impressed with your calm and composure talking to your daughter. You mind if I ask you a few questions? And she says, whatever. And he says, well, first of all, how old is little Jennifer? And the woman says, I'm Jennifer. Good? Your mom told me that story. Yeah. He tells that story to illustrate the principle in parenting that sometimes talking to yourself is not a sign of insanity. But I tell it because that story has classic story structure. Look what happens. Good stories start by introducing us to a character called the protagonist. It's the person we're going to follow through the story. If someone comes up to you at a business meeting or a party and says, hey, I've got a story for you, you're all ears. But somewhere in the back of your head, whether you know it or not, is a little voice saying, who's this story about? Is it about you? Is it about her? Is it about me? Who are we talking about? So right away, you've got to tell them, this is a story about Richard Eyre. And you've got to give me a little bit of detail, what we call his world in balance. Who is he? He's a parenting consultant. He looks for moments of good parenting. Day off, supermarket. You got the picture. Once you got the picture, the next thing you want to know is sort of like, let's get this story going. So something has to happen. That's what we call the inciting incident. Woman passes behind him. He hears moment of good parenting, wants to know how she does it. He has a goal. Somebody wants something. A story is in motion. It can be as mundane as a guy in a supermarket. It can be as romantic as the knight in the castle gets the call from heaven to rescue the damsel in distress, and he's off on his horse. It can be you sitting in your office and someone comes in and says, we need more affordable housing in Philadelphia. We need 120 units. You're in charge of the siting. Go make it happen. Somebody's got to go do something. A story's in motion. The next thing that happens is critically important. The hero can't just make it right to the goal. If they do, there's no story. So they've got to run into some type of barrier or obstacle. Something gets in their way. In Richard Eyre's case, it's shopping carts. It's just trying to track this woman down. For the knight, it could be a fire-breathing dragon. For you, it could be a neighborhood that says, not here. But something happens where our hero runs into a barrier, and this is a beautiful moment because at this point, the audience leans forward and says those magic words, what happens next? And then what happened? Tell me more. They want to know. So your hero, maybe they find a way around that barrier, only to run into maybe another barrier and another. In fact, the more the merrier, because this is what we call the rising action of the story. This is where it gets more interesting. With every barrier, there's more tension. There's more drama. Now you have to root for the hero. Is she ever going to make it? Is he ever going to get there? You ever see the show 24? It's this on crack every week. For real. Until our hero makes it around the final barrier and we get to what we call the resolution, which is how the story ends up. And that may or may not be the attainment of the goal, but it's enough to say, oh, that's how it ends. The curtain can close. The end. We can all go home. If you've ever studied playwriting or screenwriting, this is the classic three-act structure. You've just seen it. And they teach you out in Hollywood, if you take a screenwriter course like I did, a little handy way to remember this three-act structure. Act one, get your hero up a tree. Act two, throw rocks at him. Act three, bring him down safely. You've all just taken the Hollywood screenwriter's course. You all owe me $350. So think about a movie you've seen recently or a TV show. I'm willing to bet, if you kind of lift the curtain and look closely, is this not the structure that you're seeing? Does this look familiar? What people tell me in my workshops is that they can't see movies anymore, TV shows, without seeing this. It's like it's now they can't help it. It's there. I'm not saying that this is the structure of every story ever told. If you have children and you've ever read Goodnight Moon to them, for example, yes? You know, Goodnight Mush, Goodnight Brush, that's pretty much it. You know? There's not a lot of barriers in this one. And if you have a young child who you're trying to put down at night, believe me, this is the express train to Sleepy Town. It's great. But if you have a room full of adults, they need a couple of surprises along the way. So, structure. That's the structure you're hanging on. And then when you start choosing your words, if we had more time, I would tell you more, but my one piece of advice about your words is watch your language. Watch your language, non-profiteers, because we fall in love with our jargon and our technical language. I like to joke, what if a non-profit had been hired to write Nike's slogan? This is what we would have written. Who likes this better than Just Do It? Nobody. Nobody. To sum up this portion, I want to show you a 60-second story told by a nonprofit in Southern California working with children with autism and their families. It's a nonprofit called Surfers Healing. And I want you to watch it now with new eyes. Because watch this 60-second story. And watch how they will touch all the bases. They'll answer the question, who is it about? They'll answer the question, what does he want? They'll answer the question, what stands in his way? Excuse me. They'll answer the question, how has he overcome that barrier? And then, what's the meaning of the story? They'll touch all the bases of storytelling. So hopefully the technology will cooperate. This is a 60-second commercial called Without Sports. This aired on ESPN.
My name is Izzy Paskowitz, and I've been running surf camps for autistic kids for 7 years. We get them down to the beach. The kids are going to scream. Some of the kids, they don't know how to speak. The only words that come out of their mouth is screaming. To see that screaming and the kicking when they go out, and when they turn around and ride that wave in, it just nothing like it. And there's the parents, tears in their eyes, saying, man, we've had a lot of tough times, but today was just a perfect day.
Isn't that lovely? Just love that spot. So, who's the protagonist of this story? Who's it about? Not the kids. Izzy. It's about Izzy Paskowitz. He's the guy who has a goal, and what is his goal? What does he want to do? Yeah, listen, we're not curing autism today. We're going to take these kids out there, and he's going to share the joy of surfing with these kids and these families who are otherwise dealing with very difficult times. And by the way, the backstory on Izzy is he grew up surfing, and then his first son, was born with autism, and he would have terrible tantrums that he wouldn't know what to do about. And then one day he just got the idea to take him out on a board, and all of a sudden he was calm. And he thought, maybe there's something here, and he formed a nonprofit called Surfers Healing. Okay, so he wants to take the kids out and share the joy of surfing, but he has a barrier. He hits a barrier right away. What stands in his way? The kids are afraid of the ocean, and they're screaming. They don't want to go. They just don't want to go, right? You saw them literally kicking and screaming on the beach, right? How does Izzy overcome his barrier? He just takes them. That's right. Sorry, just text them. This technique has a name in parenting. It's called, we're going. Right? We've all used that. And what's the meaning of the story? Why tell this story? What do we learn at the end? Speak up. Yes. Without sports? That sports can be transcendent. That sports are more than won and lost. That it can be something much deeper, much more profound. There's also the wonderful meaning of the work that Izzy and the other surfers are doing there, but that's what ESPN chooses choose to tell the story. So you see it's all there. And the other lesson here is 60 seconds. You don't need to go on forever. Now, yes, there's some other things happening. There's some beautiful visuals, very haunting music, but basically the story that touches all the bases. So last question. How do you build a storytelling culture? Please take a moment to read that. See, I just think this makes intuitive sense, because if you accept the notion that you as an individual are really best understood as a sum of the stories about you, then doesn't it make sense that an organization will really be best known by the sum of the stories about who they are and what they do and why they're worthy of support? And based on the way human beings think and remember, wouldn't stories be a better way to communicate than mission statements and lists of core values that, you know, nobody remembers? So what are the stories? I'll give you 6 categories. This is your homework. If you can tell a story about each of these categories, one or more, then you truly have captured your lore. And if everybody on your staff, every board member, every staff member, every volunteer knows these core stories and can tell them, now you have an organization that can talk about itself in the most powerful way possible. The first category is what we call the nature of our challenge. You ask yourself, what is it that's going wrong in the world? What's the problem that we're here to address? And don't tell me, well, the problem is 17,000 people suffer with this. There's 23% more of that, because those are just numbers. Tell me a story about somebody living in difficulty, about some system that doesn't work, something that needs fixing, so I can get my mind around it, and now I'll get a feeling for why you do what you do. What's the nature of your challenge in narrative? How'd you get started? What's your creation story? Often in your creation story, there's something there about the people or the reason that you were formed that informs what you do today, whether you're 5 years old or 100 years old. I'm shocked at the number of organizations I work with where I walk into the room to work with the entire staff and I say, how many people know where this organization came from, know how it began? And half the hands go up. The other half, they walk in every day just thinking that someday magically the building appeared, right? You got to know where you came from. So know your creation story. Emblematic success stories. The word emblematic is key here because everyone collects success stories. We all do that. But what I mean by emblematic is, how are you making a difference that is unique to your approach to the field? Because if you're working in health or the arts or environment, education, whatever, chances are there are other organizations that overlap with yours. In LA, where I live, the air was very smoggy, you know, 20 years ago when I got there. Now I get fundraising letters from Environmental Defense Fund and Sierra Club and Coalition for Clean Air and others all saying, we clean the air. Well, they each need to tell a different story about how they did it. They each need to have an emblematic success story if I'm going to give my money here as opposed to there. So what are your emblematic success stories? Stories about your people. You know, you have remarkable people working for you. It's okay if every once in a while your people are the heroes of your stories. If you have on your website or your brochure somewhere a list of core values, I'd like to see stories of your people living those values. The striving to improve story. Sometimes you screw up. Sometimes you fall short. Sometimes you outright fail. But hopefully you learn from it and you do better next time. And here's a story that illustrates that we will not tell out to the world. We don't need to promote our failures to the world. But internally, it's real good to have when someone screws up to say, let me tell you the story about the time Brent screwed up and what we learned from that. Okay? Brent's a friend. I pick on him all the time. And lastly, the where we are going story. Stories about the future. If we do our job well, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 50 years from now, what does the world look like? And again, you could say to me, well, if we do our job well, 12,000 more of this, 37% less of that. Not going to have the same appeal as taking me into that world and letting me see it through the eyes of somebody now living a better life. So these are your categories. And if this works for you, great. If it feels generic, then I'll give you another way of coming at it. Go to your websites. Go to your brochures. Go to anywhere where you list the things you do or your principles, and let that be the beginning. Greater Philadelphia Cultural Alliance, I met with them yesterday. Tom, where are you? Where's Tom? Is he still here? There you are. I met with him yesterday, and I said, you know, there's plenty of points of inspiration here. Here's to all the things the Greater Philadelphia Cultural Alliance does. What I would like to see is, you know, if we do advocacy, if we save money, if we do these various things, click on a link to a story that's an example of us doing it. Show the people how you do it. Or go to that page where you have your vision. See the vision here and these four bullet points? These are wonderful things to be visionary about. Tell me a story about what that looks like, either how you're achieving it now or what Philadelphia looks like if you achieve it. Use narrative to pull people in, because this stuff can be very abstract. But I'm not just picking on Greater Philadelphia Cultural Alliance. We all do this. So go to your websites. Look at where you have that list of things you do or promises or vision or whatever and ask yourself, do we have stories to back this up? If so, put them on there. If not, go get them. If you can't get them, pull that stuff off your site. And lastly, one more idea. Sometimes you can go to the people that you work with or the people you serve and say, we've been serving this community. Tell us your story. And give them a way to do it that's easy, but lots of people do this. Barack Obama is doing this right now, asking people to share their story of living through this economic crisis so that his administration can be better informed and can tell personal stories. The YWCA, look at their mission, eliminating racism and empowering women. And that's just this week, you know? Wow. But they ask people, tell us your story of how we're doing that in your life. Help us make this real. You can do this, trust me. If the Connecticut Department of Motor Vehicles can collect stories of satisfaction, then anyone can do this. I do a monthly newsletter called Free Range Thinking that is free, keyword free. So if you go to my website, agoodmanonline.com/publications, you can download this, and I commend this issue to you, the April issue, because it's about story banking. If you collect these stories, if you really take this seriously, then you're going to need to do something with them. You need to put them in a place where staff members know where to find them, or people who come to your website can click on them. So that's a free download for you if you want to take this even further. We just have a few minutes left, so what I want to do now is I want to stop and open it up for questions and comments, and then I have one more wonderful story to share with you before we go, so I hope you'll stick around. And we have some microphones. I see one there, and we have one there. So if you have a question, raise your hand. We'll bring you the mic. There's one right back there in the middle. You see it? We'll come to you first. If you also have, raise your hand if you have questions, we get the second microphone out just in case. Not yet? All right. Yes?
How do we create a story without having to go through all the efforts of getting permission to use somebody's story? How would you mask that? If you're working with a client, can you change the name? Can you change the identity in some ways?
Okay, good question. So here's sort of the three different levels. Best case scenario is a client gives permission and you can use their name and identifying characteristic and the story feels 100% authentic. If they say, you can tell my story, but don't use my name, then use a pseudonym. That's fine. This is the story of Mary, not her real name. But the rest of the narrative will pull them out. But you do want to use a name, because if you say, this is the story of M, or a retired school teacher, or whatever, people need to hear a name. They need to get a picture in their mind of the person. And the minute you start to distance them from a real person, they disconnect. The last alternative, some people will say, gosh, if I use a pseudonym, we're in a small enough community where this woman's circumstances are so well known that they'll know exactly who we're talking about. In those circumstances, you can create a composite. and say, the story of Jane is a story in which everything that happens to Jane happens to people in our program, and all the outcomes are real. Jane is not a real person, but this is a true story. So you can do it that way. You have the license to create composite characters if your motivation is to protect privacy and the rest of the story is essentially authentic. There's another question, I think, over here. Next. And then there's one back there.
I wonder if you'd comment on your balance of humor and shock.
A balance of humor and shock. Well, you know, in storytelling, the most important thing is authenticity. I wrote for television for many years, and so I am comfortable with humor. And so if it works here, it's because I've been doing it for years. I think it's part of who I am. If you're not, don't try. You know? Nothing more painful than seeing the person who's been told, open with a joke. People love that. Yeah, and then they get up and they struggle. So whether it's humor, shock, whatever, I'd say if you can get up there in telling a story and just be your authentic self, that's the overarching rule.
I'm with an organization that's starting a speakers bureau to help people in our community tell their own story. And I'm wondering if you could speak to the kinds of support and training that you feel would be most useful to support people in telling their own stories on behalf of the organization and talking about issues, but from their own perspective, not just, you know, staff going out and telling other people's stories.
I'm sorry, so you say giving people advice on telling their own stories?
Right. And I think especially in how it inter, you know, we work with people who are homeless and formerly homeless, and
right.
Our organization has helped them become not homeless anymore, and working with people to tell that story of struggle. But I'd like to hear more from you about okay. your ideas about supporting people
yeah.
to be able to tell that story.
That's unfortunately, that's not a short answer. You've asked a very complex question, but I will say this. If you go to my website, to the Free Range Thinking, that's a newsletter I've been doing for 9 years, every month for 9 years, writing about various issues in storytelling. Many issues I write about storytelling like you're talking about. And I think it's December 2005 is an issue that's all about how to prompt those kinds of stories. Someone just asked me for this. That's why I remember. I'm not that good. But anyway, there's plenty of issues there. So look at the archives and look at the titles of the stories, and there's little thumbnails, and you'll find what you want. We have time for a couple more questions. I think we have one right here, and then over. Do we have someone on this side? Okay, go ahead.
This isn't a question. There are two organizations in Philadelphia who do that exact work.
Oh, really?
And if anybody's interested, see me after. I'm short.
Can you say the names of those organizations?
It's Patrick's Storytelling
Patrick's?
And Keepers of the Culture.
Patrick's Storytelling?
Patchwork.
Patchwork Storytelling Guild and Keepers of the Culture. Very good. All right. There was one on this side. Let's get back there.
Thank you. Thank you for coming to speak with us. I have a question. I understand that sometimes, particularly in dealing with issues around like welfare and financial assistance, that individual stories can have adverse effects when you want to connect those stories to the systemic issues of poverty.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was wondering if you could just speak for a second to how you connect individual stories to the systemic issues that we're trying to address.
Yeah, no, I've heard that argument, which is if you tell a story of individuals, that the notion is people will say, well, if we just fix things for these individuals, then that takes care of the problem. And I couldn't disagree with that more. I think you tell the story of the individual so that people will get a feeling for the problem. If we're talking about, so let's talk about cover the uninsured. When you talk about someone who doesn't have health insurance and what their life is like, you know, that is a problem. And it's not going to be fixed by just buying them health insurance. You then step back from that story and say, that person represents 47 million people across the country. So what you've got to do is you have to tell the story, get people involved, but then link it directly to a systemic problem and say, this is not about making Mary's life better and getting Mary and John insurance. It's about the 47 million people like Mary and John experiencing the same problems that they're experiencing, etc. So you start at the micro, but instantly link it to the macro and say the solution has to happen at the macro level. So that's the way you do that. I think we have time for this gentleman right here, and then we're going to wrap up.
I'm with a youth mentoring program that's in the suburbs, and we're actually doing our own website right now. And the funny thing is, I've looked at all those best practice guides for how to convey information about our organization, and you know, a lot of them looked like the vision statement that you had up there. And my director has been saying, we want to tell stories, let's break this down into stories. But the challenge I'm having and we're having as we're doing this is we've got this story right here. This is a wonderful story about Kyle. It's one full page.
Yep.
It goes through everything. But how do you take from that to create the stories that are most compelling? Because when I read it, I come to tears.
Right.
But it would probably take, you know, a little bit to get someone to read this full page. So how do you make it pithy enough for someone without, you know, taking away anything from that personal story that someone's written?
That's also a good question, because you can have a good story, like the story of Kyle, but depending on where you tell it, people have different attention spans. On the web, people are not going to sit and read 1,000 words. It's just not going to happen. That's got to be either a PDF that they print out and read some other time, or it's a story told in video, which is something people will sit and watch a two-minute video. They won't read, you know, 3 minutes worth of copy. In a brochure or something like that, people will read 1,000 words. And spoken, it probably is about 2 or 3 minutes, maybe four. People will give you that. But he raises the larger point, which is first gather your stories. Then be conscious of where you're telling them and how you're telling them, because spoken or printed, video or not, there are different concerns. And if we had more time, we would talk about them. But unfortunately, we need to wrap up. That is a reasonable segue to this point, and forgive a moment of self-promotion, but I teach storytelling at much greater depth. So if you're interested in this and you want to go further, do check out thegoodmancenter.com. There's a four-week course in storytelling that goes, it's a much deeper dive than today. There's so much more to be said. But if you're interested, that's something that you can do. All right, last story, and this story comes from Peru. I was speaking in Chicago to a group like this, and when I left, someone said, on the way out, someone said, have you ever seen the commercial for the Peruvian Cancer Foundation? I was like, no. You know, they said, well, if you like storytelling, you should see it. So I went to YouTube, I looked it up, and I saw it there, and I was so moved by it, I called the agency that did it. It's Leo Burnett in Lima, Peru. And I said, you've got to send me a copy of this. Because in 90 seconds, about, they tell a story without a single word. And it's just so beautifully done. There are a few words at the end in Spanish written on the screen. What it says, for those of you who do not speak Spanish, is the magic of giving. This is about the magic of giving. So let me show this to you. Hopefully, can we boost the volume? This one needs to be a little bit louder. And hopefully, the technology will cooperate. And then I have one last thought. So my last thought is this. You have many different tools available to you more and more every day, and a lot of them get a lot of buzz and a lot of excitement. But I don't want you to forget the first tool, which remains the most powerful. Because in the long run, if you're trying to connect with people, get them to work with you, and help you make this world a better place, in the long run, numbers numb, jargon jars, and nobody ever marched on Washington because of a pie chart, I'm pretty sure. Stories get stored. And once your stories are in the hearts and minds of the people you want to reach, and they're telling them for you to other people, then you have the world's oldest form of viral marketing working for you. And at that point, then the curtain can close and we can say the end. But for you, the end is really just the beginning. Thanks very much for your time and your attention.
Thank you, everyone, for coming. And let's give Andy one more round of applause. Thank you. And also, happy birthday to the Regional Financial Foundation Center. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.